Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition Smart Bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
Hello, guys and girls. The program you are about to hear will be both fun and educational, but it is not a substitute for medical advice. Although we are doctors, we are not your doctors.
Hello, and welcome to Travel Medicine. As always, I'm your friendly neighborhood internal medicine doc, Dr. J.
Hello, this is your amazing pediatric infectious disease doc and researcher, Dr. Santosh.
So we're still kind of riding high off the eclipse a couple weeks back now.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. It was from so many people who I've spoken to, first-time eclipse watchers, you know, repeat customers, they all describe it as a very beautiful and surreal and kind of awe-inspiring.
And we briefly mentioned during that episode about how ancient civilizations reacted to the eclipse. And it got me thinking, and apparently you too, yeah, about have we seen any of that represented in film and television, and like this led us down a whole path until we ended at Apocalypto.
Yeah.
which I think was that Mayans? I feel like that was the Mayans.
I think it was Mayans, yes, because we're going to be talking about a peoples that are adjacent, but not the Mayans. But yeah, I don't know why, but I reviewed the wonderful notes that you had taken for this episode, and I immediately started doing the impression of the Key and Peele valets talking about the movie Apocalypto. I won't get into it because it gets pretty raunchy.
But yeah. Usually when we're visiting ancient historical periods, we tend to focus on the same. I'm constantly in ancient Egypt or ancient Greece, or if I feel like being particularly modern, Victorian era.
Yeah. Now, you and I have taken the Wayback Machine to a few other places. We visited ancient China and ancient India, various periods of time during different dynasties and such like that. But those three are definitely your favorite.
Easily. And that's also because there is an abundance of information on
them. Oh, yes.
Whereas with some of the other early civilizations, written records aren't easily found, which makes it very difficult to review them.
Yeah. And there are times where, unfortunately, because the civilization their practices and that kind of thing were passed down by maybe a dead language or oral tradition. And then when they were recorded by colonizers and conquerors and that kind of a thing. So it was completely inaccurate. So it is a little bit more difficult to synthesize what was going on. Although a lot of them had amazing contributions to the field of like science and medicine.
So this week, I figured we would steer the Wayback Machine over toward the Americas. Ooh. And check out one of the indigenous peoples, a pre-Columbian civilization. And that's going to be the Aztecs.
Ooh. Very, very nice. Now, remind me again, because I always, when we talk about native cultures in what is now South and Central America, I think of the Mayas, the Incas, and the Aztecs.
You forgot the Olmecs from Legends of the Hidden Temple.
Gotcha. I'm so sorry. The Aztecs people, were they the ones that we generally think of as associated with the country that's now Mexico, or were they in a different spot?
Yeah, so I was going to say, the things that most of our listening audience, including myself prior to some deep-seated research, knew about the Aztecs are they had a thriving civilization centered mostly around the area that we think of as Mexico.
Okay.
And they practiced human sacrifice, and they also played a game called Hialeah that comes up a lot as a crossword clue and apparently was fairly bloody, and like losing teams would be executed. So they were a very agro civilization from what is common knowledge.
Yeah, lots of human sacrifice. Their gods and mythology are full of one god tearing apart another, or ripping apart the intestines of something, and then the intestines fall onto the ground and then become something or so. We learn a lot about these kind of things because it's kind of eye-catching, but it is definitely not a complete picture of this very, it was a vast civilization, and they were around for a long, long time.
So this week, we're going to take what you know about the Aztecs, which I'm guessing for most people is those three things I mentioned. And we are going to build on that and talk about what they understood about medicine. Now, some of it is a little out of date. Some of it is flagrantly wrong. But okay. All of it is pretty fascinating, including the sources we have.
Oh, very cool. Yeah. Allow us to be your guides as we examine the literature that we have available to us and, marvel and ooh and ah at some of them and make a few corrections along the way.
So when we've talked about ancient Egypt, we have a whole bunch of papyri we rely on as the Egyptians left very extensive medical records. But when we're talking about the Aztecs, there's two documents that are so unbelievably outstanding that essentially every single study of Aztec medicine quotes both of them.
Oh, okay.
And these are the Badanius Codex and the Sahagzin Codex. And just for any scholars, knowledgeable people out there, there's going to be so much mispronunciation in this episode. We know you can send us corrections, but just understand we're going to be mispronouncing a lot.
Yeah. And, with full respect, we do know that there are forms of Aztec, Mayan, and Incan languages which are now being kind of retaught and resurrected in order to continue that culture and such. But to some degree, we don't fully know how this would have been properly pronounced, way back when.
Oh, I mean, that's giving us so much more credit. I'm just saying, I can barely pronounce modern languages.
Oh, sorry. Okay. Yeah, that's fair.
That's why I avoid covering a lot of stuff that takes place in France.
Yeah. Josh, let's talk about, you know, neurology, you know, in the, you know, late 18th century. What? No, didn't happen. No.
It's important to place the accent on the right syllable.
That is true. Yes.
So a little about our source material. The Badanius Codex was the work of a physician named Martin de la Cruz, who was a student at the Franciscan convent of Tlatelolco. Not loco, loco. You know what? Just run with me on this. which you might be asking, why is it not named the Cruz Codex? Well, there's a very good reason for that. It is instead named after Juan Badiano, the Mexican scribe and Latin teacher at Tlatelolco, who in 1552 prepared the Latin version of all the medical information given him by Nahuatl, which was Martin's indigenous name, Nahuatl de la Cruz. Okay. Or it was given in Nahuatl, the language of the Aztecs, by de la Cruz, under the title Libellus de Medicinalibus Indorum Herbis. And this was found in the Vatican Library around 1929. So written in the 1500s, not found until around the Great Depression, buried in a box in the back of the Vatican.
Yeah. And it, for those who are looking at Indorum Herbis, I think Indorum is that Indian? So they still thought that, you know, or using the term of, oh, this is, you know, this was India. I'm not sure if that's what they were thinking of.
I think anytime we mention Indians in this particular episode, we are not referring to your people, Santosh.
Yes. Yeah, yeah.
But this instead is the indigenous people of the Americas.
Got it. Okay. So essentially the book of Indian medical herbs. That's what they were trying to make. So de la Cruz was a native Aztecan. He was converted,
indigenous,
or
he was an indigenous physician who was converted. There was a Mexican scribe who took down all the information that he had learned from these native people.
And
the person who wrote the book, like literally wrote the book, got the credit, as opposed to the one who dictated it.
Got it.
So that's the Badianus Codex. The other one, the Sahagin Codex, is a group of manuscripts written by a Franciscan friar, Bernardino de Sahagún, who arrived in Mexico just 8 years after the conquest of it in 1529.
Okay.
And then devoted the rest of his life to doing an anthropological study of the Aztecs. So the Aztec civilization was still thriving around the 1500s. So we have firsthand records of its destruction, but also their treatment, their life, these pre-Columbian civilizations. And his general history from the Sahagún Codex of what he called New Spain was prepared by getting data directly from informants, and even today is an accurate and reliable work. Most of our information on all of Aztec society comes from this record.
Oh, wow. Just to give people an idea of, you know, we're in the 1500s, and how long had these civilizations been around for a while? We're talking about, you know, like 955 BC was the previous one, the Olmec civilization that you talked to us about. But then the Aztec cultural achievements inherited from, you know, the Toltecs and they arrived in their home area was like 900 AD or so, and founded their capital in 977 AD. So we're talking about, what, 500, 600 years of accumulated knowledge?
easily. And the Aztecs are still around today, as they did continue to interbreed with the indigenous people, with the Spanish colonizers. And a lot of people in the area around Mexico do still trace their bloodlines back to the Aztec times, although I don't know that the language is as preserved. Like I said, yeah, we're a little bit outside of our traditional areas of knowledge, Santosh, which is why we do this, to learn more about what's out there.
Oh yeah, 100%. I do know that in recent years, there has been a movement of people of native and indigenous blood who are trying to recapture the knowledge from their ancestral civilizations. So I do know those types of efforts are underway, especially in people who trace their ancestry back to the Mayans. So I wouldn't be surprised at all if there weren't very hardworking and, you know, kind of wonderful ingenuity type of people who are just saying like, oh, I'm going to go back and learn what my, you know, great, 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 great ancestors did.
So the Aztecs had a large number of gods. So we're going to mention a couple of them along the way.
Ooh.
Now, remember, a lot of these are coming from firsthand sources that date back to the 1500s. So they were collected and written at the time the Aztec civilization was still thriving. And then just the knowledge was lost for a long time and only rediscovered in the early 1900s. So the mother of the gods, Teteoinam, or Toki, was the goddess of medicine and medicinal herbs, worshipped by physicians, surgeons, phlebotomists, midwives, and women using herbs for abortions. So all of the bathing houses would keep her image in view. And the medicinal goddess was Zapotlatena, mm-hmm, who was credited with the discovery of ushiti, or it's a pine resin that was used in a lot of rituals. Now, almost the vast majority of this episode is coming out of one extremely detailed paper, which I will link to in the show notes, and it is absolutely worth a read.
Ooh.
So Aztecs, like many other ancient civilizations, considered sickness a punishment inflicted by the gods for their sins.
Oh, okay. Not at all a rare thought. This is a very common idea amongst civilizations across the globe. Suffering, illness, death, thinking about that as a curse from above.
But interestingly, whereas if we're comparing to, say, Greece or Egypt, where the sin determined the disease and any god could exact it, when it comes to the Aztecs, a close relationship existed between a god and a disease as far as cause and treatment were concerned. So Tialoc, the god of waters, was responsible, mm-hmm, for rheumatic ailments, gout, and syndromes related to dampness and cold.
Oh, where like things would swell up and fill with water.
You right. Know,
like a, okay,
so
got
like,
it.
Oh, you have rheumatism? Well, that is clearly due to the god of waters. So it's not that you sinned and as a result, the price of your sin is the ailment. It's that, no, this particular god is punishing you for something. So you have offended the god directly and they will exert their powers of influence to then give you this divine punishment or affliction, which is an interesting way of reasoning it out.
Okay. Gotcha.
So again, so was responsible for rheumatic ailments, gout, dampness, and cold. The same god punished those who were alcoholic, abusing the drink of pulque by sending them tremor, delirium, watery eyes, and twisted mouth. A fair description of what the final stages of alcoholism look like.
Yeah, especially, you know, if they stop drinking for a bit and they're highly dependent, a few symptoms of withdrawal as well.
So if you got this affliction from the god of waters, you went up to your mountain or river and you presented an offer to please the god and obtain relief. Now, this is going to be fairly graphic. Another god that we're going to talk about, Zipe Totec, the flayed god. Cheerful fellow.
Okay. All right.
Called the flayed god because he was covered by the skin of one of his victims.
Whoa. Okay.
And if you offended him, not something I advise, was responsible for exanthematic diseases, boils, scabies, skin infections.
Oh, gotcha. So he'd rip your flesh apart.
Yeah, so the god who wore a flayed skin was responsible for all the skin diseases, the dermatology god. Now, how do you suppose you hold a festival to celebrate a god of skin diseases and ailments?
I mean, if you were to make up like sacrifices and stuff like that, do you burn animal skins and things? Do you make some crackling?
No, you find people with skin diseases, you put them in a parade.
Oh. Okay, that sounds fun.
So patients with exanthems and skin infections would march in front of the procession during the god's festivities in the second Aztec calendar month, and they would also be covered with skins from human sacrifices, you know, just because. So here's the thing. You have a skin disease. The god of the flayed god was the one who had given it to you. So how do you appease him? You cover yourself with skin from a human sacrifice to obtain a cure. Can you imagine if, as a dermatologist, you're like, oh, that's a rough looking rash. Go out, kill somebody, cover yourself in skin, wait till the parade, and that should take care of the rash.
Well, I would hope that the dermatologist would be good enough to provide the sacrifice for their patient instead of like telling the patient to have to go out and kill somebody. You know? I mean,
like,
I
feel like we escalated quickly from the god of water punishing you for alcoholism with tremors and rheumatic ailments and gout to the flayed god saying, oh, you have a rash, go out, sacrifice.
Yeah.
Sacrifice someone, cover yourself in their skin, and then maybe I will cure your exanthems and boils.
Yeah.
It just seems like a lot of escalation.
It does. Yeah, those are two very different scenarios.
Then we move on to the god Tezeatlipoca, who was displeased by a breach of fasting, vows, or sexual behavior, would give you incurable diseases and buboes and syphilis and things like that.
Now, the very interesting thing here, you know, that you mentioned syphilis as a treponemal disease, there are theories, I should say, or hypotheses that are still being examined that state that syphilis, specifically treponema pallidum, not yaws, not the non-sexual, treponemas, but that the sexually transmitted infection syphilis actually was... It's one of the diseases that was actually indigenous it was present first in the New World and then made its way back east to, you know, Europe and such, where it started causing a lot of havoc, you know, after, it was 1600s, 1700s and kind of swept its way through Europe. So it's kind of interesting to think about. That if they're describing some of these STIs and specifically if there's things that are like, you know, ulcers like chancres and syphilis,
well,
this is a little bit of evidence of this.
There is some pretty heated arguments in the academic world about the origin of syphilis in the Americas.
Oh, yeah. It goes back and forth quite a bit in terms of, you know, oh, no. It was originally in Europe. It just changed from, what we saw was the other treponema, the yaws that was over there. And then other folks come back around and say, oh, no. It made its way to the New World and changed over there and came back. And we're trying to be scientific about it, but have no doubt that there are some kind of cultural and pride points that come with this as well.
But remember, the god that you offended is the one who sent the disease that afflicted you. So it's not like a sin, a one specific sin could consistently be traced back to these. So there were a lot of gods connected with venereal disease. Disease of the genitals.
That's fantastic. It's like there's too many ailments here to be attributed to just one god.
Well, the syndromes given by the informants in the Sahagdin Codex demonstrate pretty clearly that syphilis-like lesions existed in pre-Columbian America.
Okay.
And here's the problem. We can't use that, you know, back into our academic debates. We can't say that that proves syphilis existed because syphilis is known as the great imitator. It can appear like a ton of different diseases.
That's so true. It's,
without a full lab in the Wayback Machine, there's no way we're going to be able to sample these lesions and determine
that's true.
What's true. So if you offended, for example, Maquisochitl, the god of pleasures, the breakers of his rules got diseases of their hidden parts. So not just hemorrhoids, but boils and buboes and corruptions of the penis. Whereas if you offended the goddess of love, different from the god of pleasure, you would get buboes, scabies, skin exanthems, and other infections.
Oh, so one god that had the influence more over the internal sexual organs. So ovaries, uterus, prostate, this kind of a thing. And then another one that had more influence over the external genitalia.
Now, so you have all these diseases sent by specific gods, which means you need ways to directly treat. Now, some of these were medicinal herbs, applied remedies, and these were one kind of physician. Then there was a more spiritual physician, and I'm using the term loosely, who used horoscopes, predictions, and religious ceremonies, as well as proprietary ingredients. So you did see a pretty significant degree of specialization in the Aztec medical world. You had your surgeons, the Tetequi, or Tetxoxotlatictil. You had your phlebotomists, which is, I think, the first time we've seen an ancient civilization or a pre-modern civilization specifically lay out the ones who drew blood.
Oh, wow.
As their own specialty. Like, we didn't come across that a ton in ancient. Like, you had leeches. Like, you didn't need a specialty for drawing blood.
Okay. So, but this was, like, their specialty was in curing by, you know, removing blood. It wasn't. You know, this wasn't a phlebotomist like they collected the blood in order to run tests. This was
a hematologist.
Was this the kind of bleeding where removal of the blood was part of the cure?
Well, we'll get to that. Okay, so you've got your phlebotomists, which are Tezak or Teshimani. You have your midwives who are Tlamatqui or Temixtentikti, and you have your apothecaries. So the Aztec world specialized into surgeons, phlebotomists, midwives, and pharmacists.
Nice. It's so cool. And this does make a ton of sense, as we were saying, you know, 500, 600 years of accumulated cultural, you know, wealth of knowledge. This was probably developed over a long period of time, and things like this do tend to arise within a civilization when you're advancing a practice or a science, is you do get more and more specialization.
So remember, the Sagahin Codex relied on interviews with actual Aztecs living in the empire. So cool. He asked them, can you describe what does a physician do in your world? So some of the things described is the physician or a tictil is a curer of people, a restorer and provider of health, a diagnostician well-versed in the virtues of herbs, stones, trees, and roots, moderate in his acts, curing people by setting bones, providing splints, purging and potions, how to bleed, how to stitch wounds, and revive the sick. A bad physician is a fraud, a half-hearted worker, a killer with medicines because of overdosage, who worsens the conditions of the sick and endangers others.
Oh my gosh. They were talking about stewardship.
Yeah.
They were talking about proper use of medical tools to provide benefit and not to overtest and overtreat.
Also, you see a lot more acknowledgement of the female role and subspecialization. A woman physician is one who is knowledgeable in herbs, roots, trees, and stones, who can make prognoses and be trusted because of the skill. The good woman physician, and they specifically singled women out as a separate gender as opposed to saying, oh, you know, women can be anything. There were women physicians and male physicians.
Got it.
The good woman physician restores and provides health, makes people feel well, covers one with ashes, can lance them, bleed them, give potions, purges, and medicines, cures disorders of the anus by anointing, rubbing, and massaging.
Okay.
Can make incisions, treat festering gout, and cuts growths from the eye. A bad woman physician pretends to have professional knowledge. She has a friction-loving vulva. That's an interesting way of describing it. Does evil, bewitches, makes or drinks potions, kills people with drugs, endangers the sick. So you see there's a lot of overlap between the two. And then just some trash talk that really just kind of showed up like... A bad woman physician has a friction-loving vulva, which is a devastating burn.
It is. It's kind of, there's some heavy sexism here, because in terms of the bad male physician, they didn't talk about him being horny. And this is presumably as like, oh, you're a bad woman doctor. You sleep with your patients because you can't keep it in your pants. Like that's a crazy accusation.
Now, coming as a surprise to no one, the anatomical terminology of the Aztecs showed a pretty detailed nomenclature and knowledge of the exterior and interior parts of the human body as a result of the extensive practice of human sacrifice by the priests.
Oh my gosh. So this is so cool, because we talked about how it was difficult for, you know, some civilizations in Europe to study the inside of the human body, because for periods of time, it was taboo to actually open up the human.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Body and examine the insides. But the Aztec civilization had knowledge. They just went for it.
They had vivisection instead of dissection.
Well, okay.
Because imagine, Santosh, if when you went to your anatomy class when we were in med school together, rather than looking over a dead body that had been preserved, maybe things have shrunk, maybe you have a little bit that's changed from person to person, the extraction of the heart and flaying of the victim, along with cutting the different pieces of the body into parts for distribution and the ritual banquet, made the priest and the associated physicians pretty familiar with muscles, joints, bones, arteries versus veins, and the main organs. If you're carving all of that out of somebody while they are still screaming, you're going to actually have a pretty good anatomical knowledge.
Yeah. So, meaning arteries, which are going to be the higher pressure vessels that take blood away from the heart, versus veins that return blood to the heart and are going to be lower pressure. So as in, you cut open an artery and it spurts and it has a pulsation, versus if you cut open a vein, it's going to be a more steady, slow flow while the person is bleeding to death. I am at once horrified and absolutely revering the depth of knowledge of the civilization.
Well, let's continue that trend, because you know what else they didn't get hung up on, having practiced vivisection? A theory of the four humors. They're like, oh, what are you talking about? Black bile, red bile. You cut the guy open. Here's the bile. Here's the blood. This is very obvious. Like, I don't know how you're not getting this. Disease is sent by the gods as a punishment for sin and having offended them. There's none of this humor business.
Yeah. Okay, gotcha. They had a straight up understanding. I mean, not a full understanding the way we think about today, but they were much closer to the truth about how human organ systems work together in order to make the machine run, rather than an unproven, unfounded theory.
So diagnosis among the Aztec world included identifying the pathological syndrome of the patient, so the physiologic representation of the problem, along with the supernatural influences affecting his case. Oh, you've got boils on your penis? Have you offended? You know, here's what we know. You've got pus draining from there or a growth here, but did you offend the goddess of pleasure or the god of love?
Okay.
And then ailments would be listed from head to foot. So dandruff appears next to fractures of the skull because they're both ailments of the head.
Oh, yeah. That jives.
Yeah. So both the Sahagin Codex and the Badadwin Codex, I don't even know how many times I've mispronounced it by this point, offer several instances of medical practices, including a history taking. So the initial question in a case history, even back in the 1500s, where are you having pain? Kampa imits koko, to the point of prognosis.
Very cool. Okay, they're actually going through a clinical diagnostic pathway based on signs and symptoms.
So you've got a fatal prognosis, nite ix nau aisha, a patient beyond recovery, very like in the Hippocratic tradition, where you go through the symptoms. The wise physician foretells from the eyes and nostrils of the sick man whether he is going to live or die. If the eyes are bloodshot, it is an indication of life. If they are pale and bloodless, recovery is uncertain. The signs of death are a sooty color found in the middle of the eyes, the top of the head becoming cold or contracting and depressing, the eyes losing their brightness, the nose appearing thin and pointed, the jaw becoming rigid, the teeth dusty with tartar and incapable of movement. The flowing of dark or pale blood after incision are the warnings of approaching death. Finally, okay. If he should roll about and unintelligible words pour from him, such as a parrot would utter.
Like that kind of a thing.
That's amazing. That was a perfect parrot / agonal gasp here at demonstration.
Okay, so they're codifying, you know, a lot of the knowledge that we've had for a while in terms of this is what it looks like when a person, you know, basically the cardiopulmonary system is shutting down. Okay.
Yeah. Because like, hey, look, when we cut this one open, the blood is dark and slow. That's very different from our live human sacrifices. So here's a sign of death.
That it is. Yeah. Yeah. The blood flow is actually slow. So you could use that as a, you know, kind of a diagnostic thing. They were doing it in a little bit of a brutal way, but they're checking the patient's blood pressure.
They had surgical specialties. General surgeons, so were Tesoshotla Tiktil. You had phlebotomists, which we mentioned. You had barber surgeons. You had bone surgeons, because if you have surgeons, of course ortho is going to spring out of that.
And Aztec bros? There were Aztec bros?
Aztec bros. And once you've got Aztec bros, you know you've got to have bros who focus just on the head. So you've got dentists and eye surgeons.
Oh, okay. Very nice.
Remember, This is all in the 1500s. Europe Europe didn't get their shit together till around like the 1700s.
No. I some of these subspecialties in terms of how they're codified and stuff is, you know, even more than that, like a, you know, couple of centuries later. So this is awesome.
So the Aztecs were a little bit closer to our ideas in dental techniques described in both of these codices. You were supposed to rinse the teeth with water after every meal and remove food particles or foreign substances by means of thorns. The cleansing and the brushing of teeth was done with a mixture made of ashes to act as an abrasive and white honey serving as a brush. So you actually had, this is the early form of Crest. You've got the honey, which is antibacterial, and the ashes, which are going to provide the friction to remove tartar.
You'd want to rinse that out pretty quickly, though, because if the sugars from the honey stuck around for too long, that would probably rot your teeth.
Well, that's okay, because swollen and abscessed gums were pierced with the thorns and scarified, cleansing them of pus.
Like they were scarred down so that the abscesses couldn't reform.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And then you also would use a magic element by use of a dead man's tooth to scar it.
Oh, yikes. Okay.
Then you've got cactus as a major medical feature, something you don't see in Europe because cactuses didn't exist there.
Mm-hmm.
So Nopal would have the sap of the cactus would be blended with honey and egg yolk, which is what the Aztec ortho bros would use for plasters and protected natural healing. For sealing wounds, you would first sew it with hair, and then the stitches were covered by a dressing made of warm sap, which was told to be changed if inflammation or drainage occurred. So you're doing wet to dry dressings. They have early wound care.
This is so good. I understand that they don't have the degree of antiseptic care, but they understand the principle of not wanting to get a wound contaminated. We would say infected nowadays. So they're doing what they have discovered along the way in order to prevent those, you know, from basically rot from occurring. This is so, so cool. I'm sure, you know, not quite as consistent as, you know, what we have today when it's done properly in terms of wound care and antisepsis, but so good.
Well, again, they understand primary versus secondary healing, closing a wound with hair sutures versus just covering it with a dressing and changing the dressing until it closes on its own. Now, the type of stitch they developed is the interrupted suture, which you can still see in Toltec sculptures and drawings. And the places you see them are in drawings depicted how a flayed human skin could be sewn over another person to cover and cure skin diseases. Right? Did you... I know it's been a couple minutes. Did you forget that this was a human sacrifice practicing culture?
Yeah. Very, very cool to use interrupted sutures. Yikes on sewing dead people's skin to live people's skin.
Now, remember, I talked about eye doctors as another specialization. Do you recall, Santosh, I know it's been a few years since we've been med school, that Hispanic populations are more prone to an eye growth called a pterygium or a sty?
Yes. So this is on the outside of the eye, usually at the border of the iris, right? Over the conjunctiva.
Mm-hmm.
And you basically have a thickening of, you know, that conjunctiva, and then it becomes blood vessels grow into it. And it can look scary, but it can also be quite irritating and painful, depending on its location and character.
So the Aztecs understood the conjunctival growth and would dissect it out from the eye with a long thorn from a cactus. So they would separate the growth from the fleshy part of the eyeball, and once it was isolated, the growth was cut off. And then you would put some drops of women's milk with the juice of another cactus to apply to the eye to prevent further conjunctival growth. Not sure how effective that was, but again, the principle is we're seeing a growth. We're going to take a needle from one cactus, cut it off your eyeball, and then put an ointment or an infusion of alcohol onto the eye to prevent anything from growing out of there.
That's so good because... I'm sure they observed that if you just try to remove the pterygium itself, well, the pterygium is an overgrowth that basically the tissue thinks that it's trying to protect itself. Just the same way that if you get hit on, you know, a patch of skin, it becomes, you know, keratinized, that kind of a thing. So if you don't prevent that regrowth from happening, then that's it. It's just going to recur. You're going to end up in the exact same place. And they found a way to stop that. That's now, lovely.
Now, this idea of cutting things off and out starts to become a bit of a recurring theme. After all, again, we've talked about vivisection. We've talked about human sacrifice. If all you have is a hammer, every problem begins to look like a nail.
Sure.
So tumors, independently of their nature, were all treated in a similar manner. Now, remember, tumor, we're using tumor in the sense of Latin, which just means swelling. The four
yes.
words that we used to use to describe medical things way back in the day, rubor, which is redness, calor, which is heat or temperature, dolor, which is pain, and tumor, which is swelling. So if you had a swelling, like in the knee due to a buildup of synovial or joint fluid, you would treat it the same way as a breast tumor, which is you lance it, you drain out whatever is coming out of there, and then you put a poultice of a local plant to the joint. Whether or not you're draining pus, synovial fluid, anything that's not blood. And they didn't have a great understanding of lymphatic glands.
Oh, okay. So if you had a you know, like lymphadenopathy, I'm guessing, you know, tuberculosis, like scrofula.
Then we get to our our Aztec ortho bros.
Ortho bros, bone bro.
And I'll be honest, hasn't really changed a lot.
Is it setting? Because setting and breaking and setting?
Aztec treatment of fractures was immobilization using uh-huh. wooden splints bound tightly around the fracture, which even in the Saguin Codex, there's even a couple color drawings of how to perform this technique.
Cool.
The immobilization period was only 20 days, so a full Aztec month, which now would probably be too short to promote like a callus and bone healing for certain kinds of leg fractures.
Mm-hmm.
Interestingly, the Aztecs had a lot of scatological compounds. Like if you had a wound or for certain eye diseases or tumors or leg fractures, they would smear it with fecal material.
Any specific animal, or was it human, or we don't know?
Unclear.
Okay. I will say, because in the Indus Valley civilization, because cows were so sacred, and basically we learned to use every part of the cow in Hindu civilization, there is a certain cleanliness to cow patties or cow feces that you can actually use it to clean up you know, the floor of your mud hut, you know, and you know, it's actually clean enough to handle and that kind of a thing, for certain types of pseudomedical applications.
Would not improve the fracture prognosis.
Okay,
and also when done in terms of eye diseases, would cause a great and considerable amount of blindness.
Oh, yeah. Oh, poop in the eye.
Yeah.
Oh, sorry. I wasn't thinking about the poop in the eye.
So, yeah, like I said, the use of feces in Aztec medicine comes up more often than you'd expect.
Okay.
Especially given their what to me was surprisingly advanced knowledge in other areas.
Yeah.
Like, it seems like there was at least one guy who was just like, okay, but have we tried smearing poop on it? Like, I know we figured out you have to clean your teeth, we have to cut out pterygium, we do this, but, and hear me out, have you tried smearing poop on it?
I will admit that, you know, if they didn't have a system to examine and then go back and re-examine their practices, you know, go through and actually say, oh, this is useful, this is not useful, this is working, not working, statistics, et cetera, right? If you found a mainstay of medicine, meaning that it works X amount of the time for certain diseases, then extending that or generalizing that to other applications is a very common thing to do.
Then we get to their epidemiologists. Now this, you're going to be super excited, Santos. I think this will be your favorite part, which is that there's two diseases that we haven't identified.
Okay.
So there were two indigenous entities documented in these records of pretty considerable importance in population movements. And they were known as the Matlazuahadl and the Cocolitzli.
Okay.
Now, these were the major killers of Aztec in pre-Columbian times, meaning before the Spanish arrived, with smallpox, influenza, measles, cholera. They kind of overshadowed the persistent mortality, but the Matlazuahadl and Cocolitzli were the endemic infectious diseases, and identification of these terms have baffled historians to date. Like in the Nahuatl language, Matlazuahadl may be derived from the Matlati net or Matlati bluish, and Zuahadl is an exanthem or boil, so they would be bluish boils. Is all we know about the disease, and that's just based on translation of the language.
Okay.
But Cocolitzli seems to be a much more generic name, just as a pestilence or severe widespread disease. And shortly after the Spanish conquest of Mexico in 1519, the only real mention we see of it, or at least one of the earliest descriptions, is just a fever lasting from 1 to 2 weeks with a nosebleed.
With a nosebleed.
So that's one of the Spanish descriptions. You'd also get severe prostration, a headache, rash, mental disturbances, which were seen in Matlazuahadl epidemics, which were identified by the arriving Spaniards by calling it tabardillo or tabardete. So they think this was maybe related to typhus.
Rickettsial illness.
Yeah, and that's because of the incubation period and the fact that we know that rickettsia does seem to be native to the Americas.
Yes, that's true. So there, in this day and age, there are rickettsia all over the planet. So, you know, the spotted fever group of rickettsia, you can find different spotted fevers in Africa, Asia, you know, the Americas and Europe. But the original, typhus that you found over here and Rocky Mountain spotted fever, is American.
So Matlazuahadl may have been typhus. And that's because remember I gave you the description of it being called a bluish or a net. Well, if you go back into the etymology, always a fascinating thing, net in Spanish at that time meant not only like net, like a fishing net, but it was the old anatomical name for the omentum.
Over the intestines.
Yeah. So if you have an omentum with boils, that describes what the anatomy is going to look like if you do an autopsy on someone who's died from typhoid fever.
Oh, gotcha. That makes a ton of sense. Okay.
See, this is why words are important. And again, vivisecting. Of course we know that's the disease that when we cut someone open, all their guts spill out and they've got boils on them, like a net. So it's just what happens. So again, typhus is the best guess that historians have, but it could have been a totally endemic disease that has passed away with the Aztecs that we just don't know about.
Diseases, infectious diseases, do change over time. Infectious diseases have a relationship with us, essentially, and they select us out of a population, and they are selected out. Pre-antibiotic era, this would just kind of roll along as, you know, populations would live and die as they encounter different epidemics. So it is very possible, Josh, just like you said, that there are current descendants of that particular infection that have a different spectrum of signs and symptoms and incubation period and effects. But it really could just be like an ancestor of modern typhus or something like that.
So then we come to our Kokolitzli, which was a generic term for pestilence, but also may have described a separate disease.
Okay.
So again, when you're looking at the records, it refers to an epidemic of continuous high fever, black and dry tongue, nosebleeds, swelling of the parotid glands, diarrhea with a weak and accelerated pulse, the eyes and skin tainted yellow,
jaundice,
greenish urine,
okay,
gangrene, and swelling of the buttocks and extremities.
This could actually be leptospira.
It attacked mostly young people, older people showing greater resistance.
Or tularemia maybe, but I don't see the like the buboes associated with tularemia. Okay.
In the autopsies, the liver was found to be enlarged and pale, which again may be typhus, except for you wouldn't see this liver damage.
Usually not. Yeah.
So might have been a yellow fever, might have been a tularemia, although no animal carriers were named or identified.
Oh, gotcha. So it wasn't zoonotic.
As far as we know or is documented.
Got it. Okay.
And again, both of these codices, the Sahagin and Badianus codices, are arranged from head to toe. So the first has 10 books, with one devoted to diseases of the human body and medicines against them.
Okay.
The second has beautiful representations of medicinal plants, 13 chapters of pharmaceutical receipts for ailments of the head, eye, ear, nose, teeth, throat, lungs, stomach, heart, intestines, urinary tract, limbs, and for remedies to be used for idiocy. Wouldn't that be delightful?
Wow. If they found that cure, they were way the hell ahead of their time.
They did. The cure was human sacrifice. No.
Stop it.
Some of the sections in these books refer to unusual syndromes, fear, maleficent heirs, the fatigue of civil servants. Oh, we got to make sure we take care of our government workers.
Yeah.
Even back then. And the perils of travel. Both of these make a lot of use of animals, minerals, vegetables, and as I said, a lot of scatological material.
Okay.
And then, of course, you have some of the supernatural treatments. A cadaver's tooth on the head of a patient, a coyote's eye tied to the arm, flowers around the neck. But the botanical nomenclature was always pretty sound, so the name of the plant would always refer to its characteristic properties or attributes. So you have Yolosochitl, the heart flower, which the suffix sihuitl in the name meant an annual herb growing, and quahiti was tree, so chitl flower was the drug. So the actual Greek would double meaning of poison and medicine. So that means just the consistent nomenclature and the sheer number of plants utilized, 7 times more drugs among the Aztecs than the ancient Greeks knew of in the entire world.
Wow. Okay. Gotcha. So you could just break that down. Yolokshokchitl. And then if you say chuhitl, that suffix, you would know that it was annual, herbaceous. You'd know the tree that it came from, the actual flower, and the drug that it was used for.
And that YOLO was for the heart, because, hey, man, Aztecs, YOLO, you only live once before we take that heart out of you.
And then purportedly you'd live forever after that, you know.
They didn't care what happened after. They offered up the heart to... The heart was offered up to the flayed god, maybe one of the others. Maybe, like, if you eat the heart, it helps cure angina. Who knows? Like, sure. I said, this whole paper is fascinating. I learned things I didn't even know to ask about.
Yeah.
And it gave me a huge appreciation for how advanced the indigenous medicine was of the Americas. And we spend so much time focusing on Europe and the Middle East. And I wanted to make sure that we got a chance to talk about another area or region of medicine. And surprisingly not a lot of supernatural ones. We saw a lot of, you know, sometimes on the right track, but not quite all the way there, medical treatments and diagnoses. And again, look at the specializations. They had opto, they had ortho, they had, you know, equal representation of female physicians with their own disciplines within the same specialties.
Yeah. I absolutely love this. And it, the development of all of these has a lot to do with how long the civilization was around and the accumulated knowledge and experience of these people by the time they were discovered by the Europeans. So we didn't, unfortunately, we don't get to have the history the way we would, like, you know, when we're studying, you know, your favorite Victorian era, for instance, we can actually trace through and have an understanding of, oh, how did they figure this out and this kind of a thing. We don't necessarily have that knowledge, which would have been lovely, but make no mistake, this knowledge was gained through a lot of hard work, experience, collaboration, trial and error. Yes, Josh, human sacrifice.
It's a lot of sacrifice for science.
It was, but you know, the fact of the matter is they endeavored to write this information down, to keep it, to pass it on. And it was just like you're saying, because the names for the herbs and such were so, you know, kind of logically broken down. This is also something that could be passed on really, really well. The only heartbreak that I have here is that, you know, the knowledge was kind of lost and disappeared for so long before it was rediscovered. I'm wondering how much of a wonderful influence it could have had on medical discovery and innovation for the world if we had been able to retain this information and pass it on in real time.
So we will come back and do kind of maybe a little bonus episode on some more of this paper, because it's just, there's so much to cover that we could only give you the slightest beginning taste of it. That's it for this week. As always, we love to hear your comments, questions, and feedback. And I imagine there's quite a lot of questions that are coming up. This show is produced by me with a lot of help from Dr. Santosh and friends. Our theme music is composed by Rachel Leisure. If you'd like to support us spiritually, emotionally, or financially, links to do that are in the show notes, along with links for further reading. And until next time, keep a song in your heart, soap on your hands, a shot in your arm, a spin on your globe, a handy non-human sacrifice to augment your knowledge.
Or no sacrifices. You just
not... I mean, it could just be a netter. You can burn a netter. That's fine.
Oh, you yeah. Like a textbook sacrifice.
Yeah,
sure.
Yeah. Sacrifice means a lot of things to a lot of people, Santosh. We're not all Aztecs. And when you've done all of those things, pick a country, find somewhere that excites you, and happy travels.
Bye, everybody.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. Hello Fresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. Hello Fresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.